You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network. Visit jabberjawmedia.com for more shows like this one.
Welcome to the X-Man Podcast. I'm your host, Doc Coyle. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's been a couple weeks since the last episode. I've been very, very busy on the music side of things. Some of you may have already heard this, but if you haven't, I should let you know my band, Bad Wolves, just announced some pretty big news. First of which, we signed a record deal with a label called 11-7. And you might know them from bands like Papa Roach and Nothing More, Hell Yeah, In Flames, 6AM, Motley Crue. So it's a pretty big deal, guys. I'm very, very excited. We also announced that our manager is none other than Mr. Zoltan Bathory from the band Five Finger Death Punch. A lot of this stuff has been brewing for the last few months, but obviously on our end has been a bit on the secretive side of things because that's just how it is in the music business and many other businesses. We kind of let it out when it's ready. So all that stuff came out this week, and then the band also put out a new song, a lyric video done by friend of the show, Nick Hippa from As They Lay Dying and Woven War. He did the lyric video, but it's for a song called A Toast to the Ghost. I'm sorry, it's just Toast to the Ghost, all right? Let me get it right there. But if you guys haven't heard that, I'm going to play that right now. So check out this new song from my band, brandly new signed band, Bad Wolves.
We'll be right back.
So that was Toast to Ghost from my band Bad Wolves. I hope you guys enjoyed that. People have been asking when the album is coming out. I do not have an exact date, but I can tell you it will be first quarter of 2018. And the band does have a tour lined up and some pretty big shows, both of which I also can't announce just yet. But I was able to announce all that other stuff, which is really exciting for me because I haven't, you know, you guys know I've been doing other musical projects, playing with other bands. I have my other band, Vegas Nerve, but this is the first thing I've done, really since God Forbid, that, you know, has label attached to it, management, and more than likely next year is going to be really, really busy. And yeah, it's kind of daunting, but also extremely, extremely exciting. And I've had a lot of people reach out to me, and I put a post similar to what I'm about to say on social media, but I thought it was worth repeating here, where a lot of people will hit me up and say, you know, Doc, you've, you know, congratulations, all this stuff is happening, all the success, and, you know, you really deserve it, you really earned it. And maybe I can make a delineation between deserve and earn, but this is truly how I feel. I don't feel like I deserve anything. And it doesn't mean, you know, and I think you can kind of make that distinction between deserve and earn, because I feel like there's so many talented people out there. There's a lot of people that work really, really hard, and still they might not get the same opportunities I've gotten. And there are also people who are less talented than me, who don't work as hard, who have gotten better opportunities. And I just don't think you can, you know, I try not to look in at the world in those terms, because I think it, you know, if something bad happens, you know, let's say I have some crippling injury, or someone in my family passes away, or whatever, just, you know, I get fired from some opportunity that I really like, and then do I deserve that? You know, do I only deserve the good things because I try hard and I have a certain amount of talent? So I think it's a poor way to look at the world in terms of what people deserve and what I deserve. It's not something I really like to do. And I said this in the post, and I'll say it here, you know, good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people. You know, some little kid doesn't deserve catching a stray bullet that they in a situation they had nothing to do with, or vice versa. Does someone deserve to win the lottery? I don't think about the world in those terms. And with that, I do appreciate everyone reaching out and congratulating. So when people do say it, don't feel like I'm begrudging you or angry at the sentiment. I'm definitely not. I just think that I wanted to give you guys a little bit of a view into my philosophy on what deserve actually means. So with that said, I'm going to get into my conversation with Mr. Chris OJ Ojeda from the band Byzantine. He's really one of the true good people in the heavy metal community. I've known him for a long time. I think Byzantine is one of those bands that is super, super underrated and probably underexposed in the grand scheme. But if you ever seen them live, if you ever checked out any of their records, I think their skill and ability and songwriting and all that good stuff is super apparent. So I'm really glad I could have OJ on the show. So enjoy this conversation of mine with Mr. Chris Ojeda from the band Byzantine. Mr. OJ.
Mr. Coyle.
I guess around 1991, things got a little weird for that name, huh?
Yes, it did.
You know, that's not right how they did you like that.
You know, I just heard that joke yesterday in Santa Ana, and it's been a while since we've done any touring, probably about a year and 2 months, so I forgot about that joke.
Well, there's been,
and how stale it is.
Well, there's been reunited OJ fervor. You know, you had the documentary that won the Oscar. You had the miniseries. Then he got out of prison. So it's just,
yeah.
It's not right. You know,
it keeps coming.
Like your name was Harvey in the past week, You know, it's just...
Yeah.
It's been, you know, over the past few weeks. You
know, I know.
It's a little rough.
I guess I could have a worse nickname, like Pol Pot.
What's your real name?
Chris.
Chris. I always forget that. I just don't use OJ.
It's Chris
Ojeda.
Chris Ojeda.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I grew up, everybody called us Ojeda because I live in southern West Virginia and Jay's... Don't sound like H's there.
Got to say that hard J.
Yeah. But, I look lily white. So everybody was just like, okay, it's Chris Ojeda. You know, but my grandfather is from Guadalajara, Mexico. And my dad, you know, he spoke Spanish up until he was like 4.
Yeah.
And then when they came to West Virginia for the coal fields to work, you know, they kind of bastardized their name and changed it. So... We kind of just went with it, but my peepaw, he rolls over in his grave every time someone calls me Ojeda. So when I'm back home, I tell everybody I'm Ojeda because I don't want them to think I'm fancy. But right. When I leave West Virginia or leave Southern West Virginia, I say it correctly.
That doesn't make you fancy. Come on.
I know.
You can't. Well, let's say that. That's the silent bigotry of low expectations. Yeah, you have to think better of your people.
Exactly.
I would say.
Yes.
I would say, well, welcome to the X-Man.
Thank you.
And you, I guess, you would be characterized as an ex-X-Man.
How's that?
Didn't the band break up?
We did.
So that you're an ex-X-Man.
I am an ex. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Now, are you putting it together?
You're right. I got it.
Okay.
And I was the one who pretty much was the catalyst. I broke the band up, so.
Well, so sometimes when I'm doing the show, I do research, and sometimes I don't do a lot of research. It really depends how I'm feeling,
right?
To be honest. And so for this, a lot of times you have bands that you're like you're a fan of, you're friends with, and you kind of track their career and you kind of see where things are going. But sometimes, you know, you just you don't realize until you go and actually see what has happened. And so a lot of stuff I knew, but a lot of stuff I'm researching. I'm like, I remember that.
Yeah.
And this happened. So, yeah, I was like, did they actually break up? And I was like, oh, yeah, they actually did break up.
Dude, is that Anson Mount?
Who?
That is Anson Mount.
Who's that?
That's the actor for Hell on Wheels.
Okay, guys, so just for reference, we're in Los Angeles, right. California.
We're
on the Sunset Strip, and famous people just tend to show up, all right? It's just how it is, all right? This is an entertainment town.
Right.
And the guy that I don't even know, the Hell on Wheels, I guess that show, is an AMC show, right?
It is. Actually, it's not Hell on... it's the...
Hell in High Water?
No. Man, I'm going to go back and kick myself in the butt when I listen to this. But I've watched all the shows that he's in, and me and my girlfriend are big fans. I've seen a lot of his movies. He's a very good actor.
All right, so...
And he just walked by.
You want me to give you an L.A. tip?
Okay.
All right, cool. It's an L.A. cool guy tip.
Yeah.
All right. You see someone who's, like, famous, whatever, kind of famous.
Yeah.
You know, and you just ignore that.
Just ignore it.
And no, don't even tell you. Don't even like give your friend a little elbow rub. Like, yo,
right?
It's that guy from that thing. Just like act like, you know what? ain't nothing special.
Well, I can tell you, Doc. My girlfriend, she's gonna listen to this and be like, that was not Anson Mount because I know you. When we're in New York, we'll walk around and I'll be like, oh, that's that girl from Kimmy Schmidt. And she's like, no, it's not. Everybody I see, they look like someone else,
okay,
like
so
a celebrity
not,
facial recognition.
That might not have been him.
That probably wasn't him.
Oh, that guy looked pretty fancy. He was wearing a suit.
Put together.
Yeah, it was a serious situation.
I think it was him, though.
All right, so let's. I want to talk about this famous guy right here. So you guys are on tour with Sacred Reich.
Yes.
You have a record out.
Yes.
New record, The Cicada Tree. This is, what, your fifth record?
This is our sixth
record. Okay. You guys have done a lot of stuff. You've been around a long time. I remember the first time I ever saw you was at the Birchill Nightclub, opening for Lamb of God. Who else was on that show?
That was, we played the Birchill. We were the opener, and we played with Canderia, E-Town Concrete, and Lamb of God.
That's a fucking, that is like... probably one of the greatest shows anyone could ever play in Jersey.
Yeah,
it was sold out.
It sold out. I remember meeting you guys in the parking lot, and I was, you know, I was pretty amped about that. And then they had a second stage over there, and at the same time we were playing, there was another band on the other side playing called Gizmachi,
yep,
who ended up getting signed to the Sean Crahan's
Poughkeepsie, New York.
Yep. And now Gizmachi's guitar player is our engineer who's recorded our last three albums, Jay Hannon.
Oh shit.
Yeah.
Did he mix the records too?
He mixed them and he engineered all of them.
I'll tell you that, like, especially the last two,
yes,
sound fucking great.
Well, the one before that, we were just getting our bearings and working together. Yeah. And we didn't have a lot of money, a lot of time. He did as much as he could. But the last two, we started dialing it in. You know, when you work with somebody more than once, you start filling out. And yeah, he was able to tell us how he wanted it at that point. So, yeah, I think it's weird because I remember that show and their singer was over there cussing us, like, don't listen to that whack ass shit. Get over here and listen to us.
Wow.
Yeah, and then we end up going on tour with him a year later, and he apologized.
He's like, I didn't know you guys were cool.
I didn't know you were nice.
I thought because you were in the big room, you were assholes. That's how it is sometimes. That's more of a like a hip. Usually like metal people, we're all like, we're friends with everybody. I guess some people are shit talkers and haters.
Yes.
I don't know. I don't get into all that. Like,
I know.
You ever get caught between a beef? Like, you'll talk to someone from some band and they'll tell you how about, man, we just toured those, man, fuck them, man. And fuck that up. You're big nose and you just have to, and you're friends with the other band. So
yeah,
you just have to kind of like nod.
Like, yeah, you have to detour somehow.
Now, here's what I say. I'm like, they cool to me.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, that's a good blocker right there. So,
you know, I've been in a handful though, because here's the thing, you know, some people don't like me, that's fine, but for the most part, even if you don't like me, I'm not mad at you.
Right.
You know, that's fine, that's your thing.
Right. I haven't met really a lot of people that don't like you. You're everybody's,
they're
like,
out there.
Everybody I've talked to, like, I've met Doc, he's cool as shit.
I'm sure someone's like, yo, that motherfucker got a shiny ass face. He talks too much.
Yeah.
All right. He comes to our dressing room and takes all the snacks and the fucking all the beverages.
Are you the eater of snacks?
I love a snack.
Yeah.
I'm a snack enthusiast.
Well,
so I said, I'm a donut connoisseur and a snack enthusiast.
People back home, you know, in our area, they know we're friends, so they won't shit talk in front of me. So it's a no no.
So that show, I think that was 2001?
No, it was later.
Way later. It was like 2003.
We hadn't released our first album on Prosthetic yet, so it was 2003. At that time, we had caught Chris Adler's ear,
yeah,
and we only had demos. And he said...
So how did you get in touch with Chris Adler?
Okay. We formed the band in the summer of 2000 and immediately just started writing songs and putting demos together. We only had a drum machine. There wasn't a lot of drummers back home that were fitting the vibe of what we wanted. So we were, you know, just recording a couple songs and releasing it, I decided to contact four bands through MySpace and send them the demo. And
Which four bands?
I sent it to Chimera,
mm-hmm,
Killswitch Engage, Shadows Fall, and Lamb of God. And the one that I thought I shouldn't send it to was Lamb, because they had released New American Gospel, and it was so brutal and raw. I was like, they're going to hate our shit.
Why? I don't understand that.
Just because they, you know, it was so scary, and we were a little light in the pants at that time.
Really?
That's your...
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah, well, some of the demoed songs that didn't make it to the next stuff, you know, were a little lighter.
Oh, okay.
More akin to what we do now.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So a couple months went by and Chris Adler got a hold of us and he's like, "Hey, I got the demo, you know." And also our website administrator was good friends with their street team guy,
mm-hmm,
a guy named David Allen. So we had that
shout
extra.
Shout out to David.
So we had that extra connection. So Chris said, "Hey, why don't you guys just come out and do some regional shows with us?" He was like, "We're getting ready to release a new album called As the Palaces Burn. We need an opener." So we went out just on a couple short weekends with him. We did, and we had just hired Matt Wolf as our drummer.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, it was very formative in our career. We were going out and playing with Lamb of God, and then we would go and they'd be like, "Oh, okay, you're playing with the Red Chord and Nora,"
yeah,
and these
That's
bands.
It's a statement that you're kind of, you're It's like getting into the big leagues.
You're, yes.
You're stepping your foot in that door.
Yes. So we would go out on a long weekend and go play Lupo's or,
on good shows.
Crocodile Rock on great shows. And we were getting our asses handed to us every night. It was embarrassing.
It's great, though, right? Because that's the thing is, I think, when you're stuck in your local kind of bubble.
Yeah.
And you're, in many ways, you're at, beholden to however high the talent level is in your kind of what you can see, because especially
yes.
previous to when like the internet age was so pervasive and you could kind of see the world stage, you were really beholden to what your environment was. So when you first got to play with really good bands,
yes.
you were like, oh, I see what's going on here. Like, we had that experience when we opened for In Flames.
Right.
In like 99, and we were like...
Really eye-opening?
Yeah, it was like, because we thought we were getting good. We're like, because it was right when we were about to sign a record deal.
Yeah.
And we were like feeling ourselves, and we saw In Flames, and we're like, back to the drawing. You know, so.
we got a good dose of that for a while.
But it's great, though, because you're like, oh, okay, and it inspires you.
Yeah, it showed us that next plateau that we had to strive for, and it was very far off in the distance, and we knew that.
But I thought you guys were fucking great.
I appreciate that.
You know, the first time I saw you, I was really impressed, like, wow, this band's fucking badass.
Thank you. I knew back then that we had something. I just didn't know if that lineup or... that we could actually turn it into what, you know, when I would see you guys play and some of the other bands, I didn't know if we could turn it into that. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, ultimately we end up doing it, but it took me a long time.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, I think it's very tough to skip steps. Like, yeah. I've seen certain bands and sometimes, you know, usually I wouldn't name names, but I'll give an example just, you know, because I'm friends with these guys and I think ultimately it's a compliment. Like, I look at a band like Azalea Dying.
Right.
Who, when I think when they came out, they got big, like super quick. Like, that first record just really, you know, it kind of just yes. started going and it took off. And I felt like, you know, it took them a record or two to kind of become mm-hmm. the band that people just, sometimes you get big and then you have to kind of grow into the shoes.
Yeah.
And it's not that they weren't good, but it's like, you know, sometimes you're just not refined. Even go back, like, you ever watch any of those old footage of Machine Head from the first record?
Oh yeah.
And
yeah.
like, they're a little sloppy and yeah. the guitar is kind of out of tune and
their like tempos are off the charts.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
And but the record was so good and mm-hmm. they just kind of took off and they had to grow into the band that they would ultimately become. But for bands like you guys, bands like us, where we didn't blow up right away, we kind of got to grow with
yes.
the status of the band
yes.
in a way.
I think it was extremely beneficial. I would have rather learned those experiences early in my 20s and be able to build off of them, then have been, you know, come right out of the gate with a lot of success, and then have to figure out how to become a business later.
Yeah. So you guys, so through the kind of Adler connection and doing these shows, is that what got the attention of EJ?
It was. Yeah. Chris was listening to two bands at that point, and he was talking to EJ. He was like, you know, there's these two bands I'm listening to. And they're kind of undiscovered now. One of them is Byzantine, and then there's a French band called Gojira. So he told EJ about them.
Mm-hmm.
The Gojira thing didn't work out. You know, I think they signed with someone else and blew the fuck up.
I'm trying to remember who
it
wasn't Prosthetic, the first couple of
records? No, but Prosthetic ended up putting out one of the later albums.
Okay.
But not the first two.
Yeah, because they were, I think they might have actually been dealing with a European label.
They were.
And then it got out. You had to get like an import or some
right.
some shit like that. Well, that tells us our friend Chris Adler has a very good ear.
He's got a really good barometer because, for yeah, what's going on.
Well, that was even a few years before Gojira even got on my radar. Like, I started getting them like around like 2005, 2006.
Yeah,
I was like, holy shit.
Yeah, he gave us a copy of their first album, and it scared us. You know, we was listening to it driving around, going, "Oh my god, this is so tribal," and just.
Scared us.
Yeah, just scary. But so we had recorded our first album with Matt Wolf as a demo, and we gave it to EJ, and he said, okay, I think the songs are good. Re-record the whole thing again and give it back to us with a better production. So that is ultimately what became the Fundamental Component, which was what we toured on in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beginning of the end.
What do you mean the beginning of the end?
It took three albums for us to, you know, we had a three album deal with Prosthetic, and it wasn't a very good relationship at all.
Why?
I don't know if we knew how to deal with somebody like EJ, mm-hmm. who was very business-minded. You know,
okay.
Sound scans, what are you guys doing?
Yeah.
We were unprofessional 20-year-olds we were entrenched in trying to figure out how to pay our bills and keep our girlfriends and wives happy.
Were you guys, well, I mean, if you're in a band, you don't, you just, girlfriend, I'll see you later. You don't get to be happy. That's
right.
Not how this works.
Yeah.
Sorry to my ex-girlfriends. I apologize. And my current girlfriend, if I've offended anyone. Were you guys at this point attempting to do the band full time or trying to get on that level, or were you kind of doing this bounce back where you were essentially working jobs and then touring when you could?
Yes. We were.
Which one, the former or the latter?
The latter.
Okay.
We was doing that, but we were working towards trying to become a full-time band. But yeah, at that point, we were basically playing for nothing.
Yeah, you guys, I feel like this is just my opinion, and
right.
You know, you can kind of give me your thoughts on whether you think it's accurate or not. But in many ways, to me, you guys are a new wave of American heavy metal band.
Yes.
You know, that sound, and I feel like, but you came to prominence or really got on the scene in a time when a lot of us other bands had already been established,
mm-hmm.
and then the scene started to change, so you didn't really get to benefit from the spike,
right.
in the way that we did or All That Remains did, and
yeah.
and really the last couple bands that got in kind of in that got a bump from that was like Trivium,
mm-hmm.
or maybe even bands like Bury Your Dead or something like that kind of
yeah.
got on the tail end, or maybe like Black Dahlia I'd kind of put that mix,
right.
So it kind of suffered where all of a sudden the scene started to change,
yeah.
and then you're trying to like, where do we fit in, what's going on, and the Lamb of Gods and Killswitches, they're so big,
yeah.
that now it's, if you're not selling X amount of records, then you can't even get on that tour, even if they are your buddies.
True.
You know,
yeah.
it's like when we brought, God forbid, brought Byzium on, Byzium.
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 New
Byzantine
name.
On tour. I should have had more coffee. That's the problem. Oh, we brought you guys on our headline tour in 2007, and we literally had to fight with our agent because they were of the mind that, oh, it's not, you're not hot like this band,
yeah,
or this
yeah.
band has this, you know, and we had to fight to get you guys just on half the tour.
I appreciate that. I know at that point we didn't have much street heat, and
but you guys killed it.
Thank you. I really have fond memories of that tour, even though I know that was kind of at the end of.
It was like half the tour, but I thought that tour actually did pretty well.
Yeah, and it was a really, like, if someone wanted to see that tour now, it would be great, because it was Gotor, you guys, us, and Arsis, and Nemec.
Yeah.
It was a really eclectic package.
Yeah, and then
package.
The first half of the tour, we had the Human Abstract
yes.
in your guys' spot.
They did the West Coast when we did the East Coast.
Yeah,
Lake.
Well, that was a time when we were kind of doing our best to kind of shed the metalcore
yeah.
Tag, and we wanted to bring more metal bands, more different kinds of bands, and not have every band sound the same, because we had done tours previously with lots of metalcore bands, and it's like there'd be like three Walls of Death on the
yes.
same tour, and it's like, bring down, all right, everybody, I want you to kill everyone. It's like, all right, we got enough of the killing,
yeah,
and just in terms of it being a little repetitive, you know, so we were into that, and we were a diverse band, so it probably made more sense to have a diverse package.
Was
know?
That on the Constitution of Treason?
Yes, that
yeah.
was like the headline
okay.
tour of
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I have really fond memories of that, even though, you know, that was one of the tours that I thought fit well for us. Our first actual tour after we did those regional dates with the Lamb of God was with I Hate God.
Mm-hmm.
That was very strange pairing, but we learned exactly what not to do.
What
you
do
know?
You mean?
Because they were in the throes of a lot of drug addiction at that point,
okay.
and their tour manager, Chris Johnson, who is now deceased, he passed away this past year, who I became really good friends with. he was just trying to manage that, you know, from town to town to try to make sure they got their Suboxone and stuff. Luckily, you know,
what's Suboxone?
It is what you take to get you off of
heroin
and stuff like that. Suboxone and methadone.
And that was something that that whole band was dealing with at the time?
Every stop we had to find it before they could play.
Wow. But so they were actually wanted to get off.
Oh, yeah. They were currently trying to get off. But okay. If you take enough Suboxone or methadone, then you get high.
Yeah.
You can easily. And, you know, it was, I've never taken pills or done coke and rarely ever smoked weed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not my thing. So we were like really shell shocked about our first tour.
I've never experienced anything like that. So even, you know, that, I guess you kind of, that's a very kind of peculiar set of circumstances.
Yeah. So, you know, if I look over the whole course of our history, we've toured so little. It's like we've done so little touring, you know. At that point, EJ was frustrated with us because we would come back and he would be like, hey, let's go out and do 3 weeks. And our guitar player would be like, well, I got, you know, I need $500 a week in tour support.
How old were you guys at this time?
We got signed when I was 28 and our guitar player, Tony Rohrbaugh, at the time was 30. So we were a little older.
Yeah, you were.
We were older.
You were grown-ups.
He was already married with a house.
Yeah.
I had a fiance who was just on my ass about the whole thing.
Yeah.
Like the timer was set.
Yeah.
You know, and that contributed greatly to me, you know, ultimately telling the guys I can't do it no more.
Yeah, so I think that's so interesting because I feel like the more common story is closer to my situation, that when most bands are really getting their footing, they're younger. They're probably in their early 20s, and that gives you an advantage in building your band in the early years because you don't have as many responsibilities, so you can go out for those first couple years and have the expectations that we're not gonna make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it's not overwhelmingly detrimental to your life. But when you enter that phase when you're a little older,
yeah,
in a sense it can kind of help you because you can be like, all right, we have to be responsible, so let's not do stupid things. Like Lamb of God, they were a little older when they got signed. Machine Head was a little older when they got signed. Five Finger Death Punch was a little older.
Yeah.
And you can kind of make decisions in a different kind of way. But for, I guess from your guys' perspective, it hindered your flexibility to be able to kind of go full bore.
Completely. I mean, there was decisions that we had to make that other bands didn't. Like if someone lived with their parents or didn't have children, we had to take those into account, and here we are getting $100 a night, maybe. And so it was just a lot of stress. And then a lot of the issues we had with Prosthetic, we brought to them. You know, if I ever run into EJ, now Dan Fitzgerald works for Metal Blade, and he was the guy that we had to go between with EJ, and he was putting out the Byzantine fires so EJ wouldn't kill us.
But what would you describe as a Byzantine fire?
Just asking for tour support, like out the ass, even though we didn't deserve it.
But what's the fire? I mean, all they could do is say no. I mean, ultimately, they just got sick of
they got sick of it
of saying like did you guys didn't have a manager?
No, that was a very big poor decision on mine and EJ's part.
You had offers.
Yes, but he said, look, you know what? I think, you know, you guys are a little older. Why don't we co-manage? You and I, we can co-manage the band, and we can kind of, like, book it ourselves.
Well,
that's
a conflict of interest, though.
Totally.
When your manager is the label.
Right.
To a certain degree, I know there's some newer deals, like, what was it, The Firm? I don't want to actually speak out of turn on this, but there's been many changes in the music industry where you have labels, you know, what people would regard as a 360 deal, where the label gets different revenue from other aspects. Now labels are getting into the touring side of things.
Right.
So there's the business has changed where there's more kind of, as in the music industry, we say cross collateralization.
Yes.
But the reason why I say it's a conflict of interest is that essentially the label has certain priorities that a manager wouldn't necessarily have because the label's income is derived from different elements where, you know, so they might have you know, just their motivations might be a little different. Yeah. That's no disrespect to EJ, because I don't know what his
right.
I'd rather him speak for his end of things. You know, and I'm friends with EJ, and you know, and I respect him, so I don't want to speak out of turn on that. But yeah, it can get difficult.
Well, to button it up, you know, I would love to apologize to EJ now as a 42-year-old man and let them know that, you know, we had the chance, like we were getting the good shows.
Yeah,
we were just a bunch of spoiled West Virginia brats who thought, hey, we need to be able to supplement our income of what we're making at home, and you can't do it.
I don't think that's spoiled. I just think you're saying, listen, I have a lot of theories, my own theories on the music industry, and I think in a lot of ways we get kind of institutionalized to a certain degree to expect nothing or expect to be treated like shit.
Right.
And in a way, you might say spoiled, but I could also say, well, maybe you just had a certain amount of self-respect.
Yeah.
And you weren't willing to live like a homeless person just for the art, or or do it for the spirit of rock and roll. And I can't really say which way is better. Or, you know, I love that other spirit of saying, you know what, man, we're just doing it because we love it, and yada, yada, yada. I don't really know. I don't know. I don't know what to say about that, but I think you can go either way.
I looking back on it, you know, and we had 5 years we were broken up, and even now I still look back and analyze, like, what did we do wrong and stuff. I wouldn't change any of it, to tell you the truth. The divorces that we've went through, and the band firings and all that stuff, I think every one of those pieces had to fall into the puzzle for me to be here at this point, with a second chance at this first impression.
Yeah.
So, you know, those hardships, I draw from them, you know. But at the end of the day, it's all gravy. Every bit of this is all gravy. I'm sitting in Hollywood talking to you.
Yeah.
You know.
So you guys, eventually you put it down for a minute. What was that, around 2008 after the...
It was.
Oblivion Beckons came out?
Yeah, we did 2004 Fundamental Component. Right within a year, we turned around and put out the And They Shall Take Up Serpents, which is my favorite prosthetic era release that we done.
Yeah.
And then it took us 2 years to do Oblivion Beckons. We had done two tours in the UK between that time. And they were both, the first one was all right. The second one was a financial disaster, and it should have never happened. And we came back with this bad taste in our mouth that maybe we don't know what the hell we're doing. So at that point, we were writing music for the third album and going out and do regional shows. And that's where my fiance at the time had pretty much put down the gauntlet. And she said, look, I've been waiting years. We rent a house, we have no kids, and I don't have a ring, so you're gonna have to shit or get off the pot. So I made a decision to kind of pull back from the band, and it was a bad time because we hadn't finished recording the album yet.
Yeah.
So we did a lot of Fleetwood Mac rumors, to where Tony would go in and record his stuff, and I'd wait till he'd leave, and I'd go in, they'd have to fill me in, you know, what we're doing. The album reflected it.
So do you... Just kind of on a life thing, does that are you regretful about that decision?
Yeah, I mean, if that wouldn't have happened, I wouldn't have had my first daughter, Mallory, which is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. But I think I could have made them both work.
Yeah,
I was just under a lot of intense pressure at that time, thinking, because no one from back home had ever made it work. There's not many bands from West Virginia that's ever made it work.
Yeah.
So I didn't have anybody to talk to figure out, how do I make this work, guys? So,
well, I don't think that's easy, and I think so many people in bands, especially struggling bands, have had that situation. Like, I remember so many guys in Jersey that same thing. It's like they have a woman, she's ready to make, you know, they want to move forward, they want to get a house, they want to have children, they give that ultimatum, it's either the band or me.
Yep.
And I've seen. And usually I feel like a lot of men, especially if the band's not taking off or they can't necessarily rely on it financially, they're going to tend to, go and do take a more traditional path.
Yeah. I mean, we were on the third album and we already knew we weren't going to re-sign. And I think, you know, Prosthetic was at that point, like, we're not going to be putting a lot of money behind this. Well, we're not going to re-sign you.
Yeah.
So we drove to, where's James Madison University? Virginia or Pennsylvania?
I have no idea.
We drove, they had a really good college metal station, and we drove there to play a show, and that's when I decided to tell the guys that I can't do any tour anymore. It's going to have to just be local band status stuff. The problem was is that Tony's wife had just divorced him, citing problems because he was focused on the band too much. So he was dealing with this big life change, and he was like, you know what, I'm all in. Let's do it. I'm all in. So here we are driving to James Madison, and I'm like, hey, guys, I think, you know, my wife and I, we've decided to focus more on my family, and he flipped his shit.
Now, did you guys have a kid at this time? Or
no. Okay. No, we were just engaged.
Okay.
And he was like, how dare you? I just lost my family for this fucking band, and now you're telling me you're pulling out. You know? He was like, fuck you. And if this is what's going to happen, we're quitting. We're breaking it up, you know. And for the whole trip, about 5 or 6 hours, our manager at the time, Anthony Lewis, was yelling at me. Our bass player, Skip, yelling at me. Everybody yelling at me. Wolf wasn't yelling at me. He was kind of just sitting there. So I was like, God, okay, this is the end of that. But then on the, you know, a couple hours later, Wolf was like, hey, man, I'm kind of glad you did that because I got my girlfriend knocked up. So thanks.
Yeah.
I'm like, stand up.
Didn't have you back at all. Let you take the heat.
Yeah, but it's all right. You know, me and Wolf are homeboys, so I completely understood. So that was at that point we had decided we're done. Let's give them the album. Let's finish it. And then we handed the album to them. It's disjointed at best. It's too long. There's 13 songs on it. Everybody wanted their ideas on.
Yeah.
Nobody would discuss what trimming the fat. So we handed it to them, and then we broke up. We told Blabbermouth we were breaking up the day after the album came out, which I think EJ lost probably 20 grand, maybe. I mean, that's another thing I feel really,
yeah,
really bad about. As a businessman now, I'm like, I would have kicked my ass.
Well, I think so many people on the musician side of it never fail to kind of see that, especially someone like EJ. You know, he's not Virgin Records or something. He's not Warner Brothers. And this is why record deals are structured the way they are, where much of the gains, mm-hmm, are heavily favored on the label side, because the probability that when a label signs a band that the band will break up, that the record will be a failure, are so dramatically higher than that it will be a success,
mm-hmm,
that it has to be structured that way, because they're not just signing you. They're putting that against everything they sign.
Right.
So more likely they sign 10 bands, 7 of those bands are gonna fail.
Yep.
And so it's only once you're proven that you can get a deal that is more fit in your favor.
Yeah.
So this, and these are the stories, and even you, at least you have some modicum of you know, you feel bad about that, and you're empathetic. You know,
yeah.
Which is rare.
Is it?
I think
that's
so.
Good.
I think in a lot of ways, I think a lot of people are generally looking for their end of things. They're like, how's it gonna work for me? I don't really care. And you know, I think in many ways, the best business owners within the music industry are should be mutually beneficial.
Yes.
And works well, and no one's fucking this person. Oh, I'm trying to screw you over. Everyone should do well.
Yeah. I mean, if that was the end of my musical career, I could have easily just turned it around and said, they screwed everything up.
Yeah.
It would have been easier to live with.
But that's usually the story. But that's usually the story you hear.
Yeah,
right.
It is.
Is that the label screwed us? They did this. And listen, I'm not saying that doesn't happen. It definitely does. But there's also, sometimes it's also how you frame it.
Right.
Like how am I looking? I can definitely frame this in a way where we're getting screwed, and I can frame it in a way where it's, you know, people are ultimately looking out for their best interests, and
yeah,
you know, you have to kind of understand that.
I mean, I deal with one band with 4 other band members, you know, and sometimes it's trying, but I've got really good human beings in my band, and they take it seriously. I couldn't imagine being in the label to where you have to deal with 13 or 14 bands,
yeah,
broken up into 5 members, that, you know. So, you know, I used all that as a springboard to figure out, after 5 more years of sitting around on my butt, how can I get this back on to the right track, you know.
Yeah, so you guys did some... You did a you reunited a few years later, did some local stuff, right?
We did some reunion shows, trying to see if Tony would be interested in doing it again, you know, and we did the shows, and they all sold out, and everything was great, but it wasn't there yet. There was some, between me and Tony, it was like a divorce.
Yeah.
You know, like, you take the house, I'll take the dog, you know, and he didn't want to talk to me, but he ended up having a heart attack.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Tony used to smoke a lot, like he was packing half a day, and he also used to like to run on the treadmill. So he would smoke and then run and smoke, and he ended up having a mild heart attack around 2011. So I reached out to him and said, "Hey man, I hope you're doing well. I love you," you know, and that kind of brought everything back together. So 2012, we decided to just reform as a local band, rehearse and see what we come up with, and we had all the music, you know, for the fourth album within like 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, the self-titled. So what did you guys use to, what service did you use?
On that one we used Kickstarter.
And how did you like that whole process?
It was nice. Kickstarter was the bigger one at that time, and we got more foot traffic going through them. The only thing that I didn't really like about Kickstarter was I kind of had to do it all myself.
Yeah, you're on your own.
Yeah, and the next one we did, which was two releases to Resolve, we did it with Pledge Music, and they assigned me a guy that helped me. Mm-hmm. So he would text me or call me and be like, "Hey OJ, you haven't posted in 3 or 4 days." And that was fantastic. I'm a real big fan of Pledge Music.
They take a little bit more cut, but they help
do
out.
But they help on the management side, and when you're a struggling band trying to get your feet again and you're out there doing day jobs and doing this, I would rather pay somebody to do that stuff for me.
So that record didn't end up coming out on Metal Blade, or
we self-released two, and the second one, Two Releases to Resolve, which we did in I think 2015. Let me backtrack. The fourth album, the self-titled, we hired the Syndicate on a really low budget just to do a small college PR push. That worked really well. But the second time come around, I said, "You know what? I'm going to spend every fucking dollar we got." Mm. We ended up spending $30,000 on an independent release, most of it on press.
And that was all done through the crowdfund?
No. Crowdfund, I think we raised 13. The rest of it was credit cards, and I took loans from my mom.
Really? So what?
I still owe my mom for Two Releases to Resolve. Really? I've got it down to $9,000 now.
Wow.
So
what's the impetus on taking a risk that large? Because you literally thought you were going to get it back on record sales, or?
No, I didn't really care if we hit the black. I knew at that point I had written some demoed stuff. I knew at that point that I had more gas left in the tank. Mm-hmm. And I knew how happy I was at that point, because around 2013, my wife divorced me. I went through a really dark period, and that was when I was writing music for Two Releases to Resolve. Mm-hmm. And that's where the album title comes from, because we released each other and resolved our issues, because mm-hmm. now me and her are great friends.
That's awesome.
Great friends. She's great friends with my current girlfriend. We co-parent. And it also was a tie-in to releasing Tony from the band. Skip left, our bass player. Like, it was an all-new band except me and Matt Wolf.
Hey, what's up? This is Blake Weiland. I'm the host of the Tone Mob Podcast. It's a show where I interview guitar people about guitar stuff. We talk about their pedals, their amps, their accessories, their preferences, all that stuff, as well as a healthy dose of whatever comes up. Topics have ranged from aliens to addiction and anywhere in between. Oh yeah, and pizza. We're definitely going to be talking about pizza. So get the show wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Just search The Tone Mob in your search bar and it will pop right up. Come join us. We're having a lot of fun. Thanks for checking it out.
One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we both celebrate and have a good laugh about bands and artists that had just one hit that we all know. Each week, we're joined by a guest from the world of music or comedy to learn more than you ever thought you would about some songs that you can't forget. And we decide if they brought the One Hit Thunder or were nothing more than a one hit blunder. Look, if you listen to the show, you're probably going to laugh, and I guarantee you're going to crush next time the bar has music trivia. Tag Team, Jane Child, Meredith Brooks, Looking Glass, Sean Mullins, Eiffel 65, EMF, Crash Test Dummies, Crazy Town, Chumbawamba. We have hundreds of episodes in our back catalog and a new episode each week. So pass the Dutchie, make sure you're connected, and subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like the Lumineers, Andy DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon.
So I was like, guys, let's throw everything against a wall and see how it sticks, because we've always been so conservative, trying not to spend anything. It never fucking worked for us. So we went 30 grand deep and ended up it working, because Syndicate got us number one on CMJ.
Mm-hmm.
We were only the second unsigned band to ever do that, behind Clutch's Earth Rocker. And then on Sirius Liquid Metal, we got to number one, and that was when Lamb of God and Slayer was on there.
Mm-hmm.
So things were validated from that money. So I really don't care if we got it back, because it helped.
No, I think that's super interesting, because after I left God Forbid, you know, I started doing a new band.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to, you know, always being in the label system and having resources, and then when you have to start putting your own money into it, it becomes this real serious question of, like,
yeah,
is what do you do? You know,
yeah.
do you put a bunch of money in? Do you take these risks? And it's so fascinating to hear when someone actually goes and puts it in. But that eventually that turned into the Metal Blade.
It got us the deal with Metal Blade. Once we started talking to Mr. Slagle, he told me on the phone. He said, I am signing you guys based on the strength of your two independent releases.
Yeah.
He said, I don't really know much about the prosthetic stuff. He said, what you've been putting out, if you can give me that and we will give you the Metal Blade marketing arm, I think you might be able to have a career in your 40s and 50s. And I was like, well, let's try that.
So how long has the record been out? Cicada Tree?
I think it's about like 2 months now.
2 months now. And how are you feeling about everything with the whole way the records come out and the push?
I feel really, really good.
Yeah.
We actually recorded it a ways back, and they shelved it for 5 months because we didn't have any tour offers.
Yeah.
But then we end up landing Dan Rosenblum as our booking agent, and then we, you know, promptly got this. So they pushed it back to where it'd be closer to the Sacred
Shout out to
tour.
Dan.
Yep.
Got to get him on the show.
Yeah, he was there last night.
He works in my neighborhood, so I see him all the time.
He is so upbeat. Like,
he's the best.
Through text, I was like, man, this guy's a shit ass. He just sends one or two words, and he talked my ear off last night. I don't know how many white guy high fives we did, but there had to have been 20 in there.
There should be a cover band called White Guy High Five.
White Guy High Five.
Just coined here.
Dan is very important to us, and Metal Blade is super important. And I feel like the cogs have kind of fell in the right place. I know it's taken us 17 years, but when Brian Slagle tells us, I think you've right now you're better than you ever have been. And he told me, he said, I wouldn't tell that to a lot of bands who've got 5 albums out. By that time, your star is already burned.
Yeah, it's not easy. And it's interesting, because I think, especially in like the thrash metal world, we had this huge resurgence of bands like Testament, Exodus, mm-hmm. Overkill, Creator, so late into their career, putting out some of the most vital material of their career and the most inspired. So I think it's been proven, even like the new Metallica record, like that, I think it's fucking amazing, and it sounds alive to me. It sounds They sound connected. They sound invigorated. And there is proof there that even though we think about metal as a young man's game, if you're doing it from a place of passion, mm-hmm. from a place of good and pure intention, you know, that there is an audience for it, and bands can have a career. You
yeah.
know? And I agree with him. I think, you know, the stuff you're doing on the new record and even the previous couple records is just as inspired or better than anything you've
Thank
ever
you.
Done.
Thank you.
Can I ask you actually a little bit about the vocal shifts you've done? Because you started out, you said originally you were doing singing and stuff on the demos, and then you just went straight screaming. And
yeah, at the first onset when we were doing demos, we had some songs where I sang, but my singing voice was really bad, so I think that's why we kicked those off, because yeah. I was pitchy at best, you know, and I had no vocal training. And Tony had such a great ear. He's like, man, the idea is there, but you can't really pull it off. So you can do the shouty stuff really well. Yeah. So that's what we focused on when I was earlier.
But then on the mid record, you started doing this almost like pitched yell kind yeah. of thing.
Shouting in key.
Yeah. And then you've kind of gone back to more like the straight scream, but then singing mm-hmm. like, which I kind of like that a little more right. than the kind of pitched yell thing.
Yeah.
So that just is just kind of experimentation.
The pitched yell thing kind of came from my favorite heavy metal vocalist of all time is Kyle Thomas from Exhorter.
Yeah.
And he is the master of shouting in key.
Yeah, he's badass.
With the power and the soul. So I started trying to do that. Like, I in order for this band to succeed, I have to just be a chameleon. I have to mimic, because my talking voice and is so bad.
What are you talking about? You have that sweet southern charm. No,
that's
baby.
The thing. It might be great to converse, but no one wants to hear that in a metal song. You know?
I don't know.
So I have to
listen. You could be the first.
I could be the first. I'm not going to try that yet. I have to listen to people like Testament or Pantera or Opeth and mimic that. And I've kind of got to the point where I can do that effectively. But earlier, it was just kind of more of a one or two dimensional thing. The second and the third albums when I added the shouting and key, and now I've developed my singing voice a little more through vocal training and stopped smoking and taking care of myself, mm-hmm. to where now I've added the singing back in. And also, I think it's going to elongate our career.
Yeah.
Because if I'm up there barking for an hour and a half, I'm going to blow my voice out.
Yeah.
So.
Can imagine it. Imagine it takes its toll. I'm fascinated by extreme metal vocals, because I can't scream.
Yeah.
And I can't, and I just, especially as bands get older, I'm like, you look like someone like Jamie Joster, you're like,
oh my God.
They, yeah. you know, they play for an hour and a half and he's just, they're playing their 25 songs. You're like, and they're doing it every night. And you're like, man, it's gotta, you know, you have to be of a certain mindset. Or even like Cannibal Corpse. Like, yeah. they play, same thing, like 2 hours,
yes.
just killing it. And like, I guess we're going to find out if 70 and 80 year old men can
right.
do extreme vocals.
I think if your vocal style is one direction, like if you got one toast and you butter that one way, mm-hmm. I think you could probably do it a little longer. Maybe your vocal folds get used to that.
Yeah.
But I've noticed it, trying to move between different styles of singing, you've got to use different vocal folds. And if you've got inflammation in one thing, your register will change. I got laryngitis not too long ago because of the weather change back home. And I was sick to my stomach all this last month because I was thinking, I can't sing right now.
Yeah.
And I've got this biggest tour of my life, you know, with one of my favorite bands on earth, and I can't sing. So it's been really frustrating, but now I've got almost full vocal command. I'm about 80% right now. We played the show last week with Baroness and Fit for an Autopsy in Pittsburgh, and I had a nurse came up, and he gave me a steroid shot in the ass, and then gave me a needle full of steroids just in case my voice goes to shit on this
tour.
And
it works?
Immediately.
Like so basically saying steroids are good and we should all be on steroids?
Steroids are good.
All right.
I flipped over the merch table, though. I was a little angry.
Really?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, these are like prednisone steroids. It's not anabolic. I'm
just saying, man. I wanna be super like you and just get better.
There we go.
All right.
But my balls got really big. So
did that really? Did that actually happen?
No. So
no flipping. No big balls. All right. You're just lying.
The only thing that happened was it went directly to the inflammation on my vocal cords and allowed me to get through that show. And then we had 4 days off, and now I'm fine.
Right on.
But yeah, the vocal shifts. It's a bone of contention for me all the time, but I have to do it. It makes me happy.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So, I'm not going to keep you too long. You have to get back inside and rock a heavy metal concert. Before we go, I want to talk a bit about West Virginia.
Okay.
Because it's been this, in a sense, I feel like it's become, you know, almost politicized. Like people hold it up like a, the Rust Belt and the coal miners. It's like become this this totem that people either use for their agendas. Yeah. And like, what is?
You saw President Trump do that.
Exactly.
He went straight there, put a coal miner hat on, did this digging thing like people actually dig coal, you know. And you saw thousands of West Virginians behind him saying, I will vote for you based on that.
And then also Hillary Clinton got in trouble for saying, we're going to put a lot of coal miners out of business.
Right.
So whichever way you are, but just coming up. So did you grow up in like the city in West Virginia, or did you grow up kind of more on the, like in the outskirts in the rural areas?
It was a rural. I grew up, my town has like about 1,200 people.
Yeah.
So, and the city, the capital of West Virginia is Charleston, and it has a whopping 50,000 people. That's the biggest city.
Charleston, is it a college town?
It is not. I mean, there's a University of Charleston. The college towns in West Virginia is Morgantown, where West Virginia University is from, and Huntington, which is Marshall, where Randy Moss went.
Now, is there kind of a different tenor in the more kind of college areas, or is West, just when you're not in a place, you know, we have, I feel like I said, these ideas of a place become distorted and stereotyped. So is there a diversity of opinions in these areas, or is it, because it's so fascinating to me.
West Virginia, I mean, we're a northern state. You know, we succeeded from Virginia, but the people in the south part of West Virginia, where I'm from, they still gravitate towards the southern way of thinking, which is odd to me. But the northern part of
why is it odd to you?
Because we're not a southern state.
But to me, Virginia and down is those people would say, well, we're the south.
Right. There's a line called the Mason-Dixon line, and it separates the north and the south area. And you know, the northern part, which is Morgantown or Martinsburg, it's a little more progressive.
Yeah.
But no matter where you go in West Virginia, you can find a holler with a trailer and a trampoline and a satellite
hold
dish.
Hold on. Just real quick. Define holler for those that don't know,
okay,
including me.
Okay. A holler is a road that goes up in between two steep mountains, and that's where people live. There's hardly no one lives on the mountains.
It's almost like a secret path.
It is, yeah. I have friends that come to West Virginia, and they can get claustrophobic because everything is between mountains.
Yeah.
Like here is wide open, there it's completely closed. So now I grew up in the southern portion of West Virginia, so like an hour and a half south of Charleston, which is the capital, and it is not a heavy metal area at all. But when my mom and dad got divorced when I was 13, my mom felt bad for me. And she had just sold a flower shop, and she's like, I need a new business. And she saw me getting into Metallica and all this. So my mom went and bought real estate and opened up a tape and record store. And she would allow
me. Are you serious?
She allowed me and my stepdad to pick all the music. So we would just, we filled it with like Forbidden and Exhorter and Pantera. And she promptly went out of business like a year later because no one bought that stuff.
Yeah. You guys, they shouldn't have listened. They shouldn't have asked you. They should have.
No, it was a bad business move. But that kickstarted, you know, this thing for me, you know, the heavy metal thing. So I got to give shout out to moms for taking the hit.
Wow, that's amazing. but it just makes me, I just wanted to kind of know from someone who's from that area, if, like I said, this whole kind of idea of like the kind of working class resentment and all this, the changing economy, like, is this something you've felt, or like, or you felt like has been communicated, like, or just a general sentiment within your community?
Well, it's,
or is it overblown? That's what I'm saying. Is this narrative being exploited?
Well, it's hard because I'm so close to the forest to see the trees.
So you feel like you don't have a good...
No, because when you go back home, it's kind of really isolated.
Yeah.
You know, West Virginia always feels like it's them against everybody else for some reason. You know, which...
Forever the underdog.
Puts them on a bad island. Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of shifting going on back home with the environment.
Yeah.
And West Virginia is a coal extraction state. Yeah. Like, that is, if we didn't have coal, we wouldn't have electricity. I wouldn't have went to college because my dad's a coal miner and paid for my college degree. But, you know, there's a lot of shifting going on, and it needs to happen because people back home are really hurting, really starving.
But that's what I'm talking about. Like, that's the stuff. So
it's real.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what I, not that I want to hear that, but I want to hear it from someone validated. Like you, who actually knows, and not just this, you know, some reporter going there. We're gonna go to the Rust Belt and check in with the people.
No, there's some hardship going on, and a lot of it has to do with that, and it also has to do with education, because West Virginia is always under budget, and every time it comes down to look at the budget, they always cut teachers, they always cut education, they always cut arts.
Yeah.
And then somehow that ends up feeding the drug scene.
Yeah.
So we have such a bad pill problem. And now it's meth, and now it's starting to get heroin because it's starting to traffic from Detroit down there.
Yeah.
So it's really, really bad time. But you know, there's an end to everything. You know, we just got to get the right people in place there to make this shift. So, but it's hard to tell a coal miner who pulls down $150,000 a year.
That's a lot of money.
That we're going to shut down your coal mine. When they have a 10th grade education,
they will
fucking kill you over that. And I understand it. So
it's rough.
Luckily, my family, almost all my uncles and my father was coal miners. My grandfather laid track in the mines. Not one of my cousins or my brothers went in the coal mines. So my parents and uncles feel really proud that they was able to transition our family out of that and send everybody to college or arts. So
I think we're at this fulcrum in society where, you know, it's I always use this analogy of, like, at one point everyone was riding horses, the next thing you know people were driving cars, and I'm sure there were plenty of towns and parts of the country where that was their main business, was making horseshoes and making saddles and breeding and things like that. And eventually you're looking around and you're like, wow, there's a lot of cars in town. And we all have to be forward thinking because the thing about change is that it's actually accelerating exponentially. Mm-hmm. So things are changing quicker,
right?
So things don't last as long. So there'll be a trend of, like, even the music industry, right? We've seen it, right? It's like, the CD lasted this amount of time, and the tape lasted this time, and even the MP3 they're saying eventually that's going to get winded down. It's just going to be streaming, and so we're on, just from the music angle, we're always trying to look at the next thing and not get kind of become obsolete within that. And I think it's there's always some blowback and collateral damage and just creative destruction when the new thing comes around, and ultimately we're usually in a better place, but but people do get hurt.
You got to go through a hard transition period, and the problem is, I think something like that, like if we're going to move away from coal production to stuff that's cleaner,
what's already happening? It's not. It's diminished.
It's just not happening home.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is because the politicians are so damn scared to push for that because they know they'll get voted out.
Yeah.
You know. So we get stuck in this mire of doing the same thing over and over, and we're always going to be unfortunately, we're going to be last.
Well, the thing is, ultimately, things like that, it's the corporations are going to do ultimately what's in their best interest. So things will, you know, politicians can kind of do their end and say what they're going to say. But, you know, things are just going to happen, just to happen. But we also don't want to be in that situation, like, where, like, you know, the only reason why, like, it costs more to make a penny than a penny's worth. But the only reason pennies are still in circulation is because the copper lobbyists. Basically, so someone's like, well, there's this town somewhere where they make copper, and we can't, you know, so it's basically they have like a job that it's inefficient, but you can make an argument for all of that. It's like kind of this thing where, like, well, we need jobs, but we don't need the thing that they're making, but if we, you know what I'm saying? It's like this.
That's a cool analogy. I didn't know that fact, that pennies were probably cost more than they're a penny.
It's super weird.
It is super weird.
There's all little things like that, but, you know, through, you know, I don't know. It's very fascinating. But, brother, thank you so much for coming on the show.
I would hate to have to add more to this, but
I want to talk about
one facet.
Sure.
About this tour with Sacred Reich.
Okay.
And my love for Sacred Reich. I have a story I want to tell.
Tell the story.
It involves me getting into my first band in high school, and it's tied into this, and it will give a good nice loop.
Okay.
So I had a group of guys back in Logan County, West Virginia, and we were all just, everybody called us skate fags. Yeah. We were skating, and the jocks were rolling
by. And sucking a lot of dicks.
Yeah.
Sucking a lot of dicks, so.
So in between the dick sucking, we would skate, and we wanted to form a band. So everybody picked their positions, and the only thing left was bass and vocals, and it was down to me and my buddy James, and neither of us wanted to be vocalists. I didn't know how to play anything. You know, I'd strum a little bit. So they were like, okay, well, you're going to have a bass off. And I was like, okay, I didn't have a bass, you know, and you're in southern West Virginia. There's no left-handed basses. My mom just bought a refrigerator, so I had a cardboard box. So I cut a bass out of cardboard, and I drew frets, and I put strings on it, and I had one of my skater fag buddies go and steal me and Justice for All Wolf Marshall tab. So for about two or three
weeks. Justice for All, the album with no bass on it.
And Justice for All, yeah. So for about two or three weeks, I learned To Live Is to Die and Harvester of Sorrow on this cardboard bass until neck just started folding and stuff.
So there were actual strings on it.
It was shoestrings.
Shoestrings.
Yeah, that I tightened down. That's probably why it's folding.
Okay. So but, you weren't really learning bass, but you were learning the concept.
I was learning the concept where my fingers went at the time.
Okay.
Because my mom had said, I will buy you a bass here in a couple weeks if you can just hold on. I got a bass off
that
coming up.
That's dedication right there.
So we had the little bass off. The other guy had a bass, and, you know, he tried and he sucked. And I flipped his bass over upside down and was able to play those songs. They were like, God, dog. Okay, you're in. So then my mom bought me the bass, and the first person I molded my style after was Phil Rind, because...
From Sacred Reich.
From Sacred Reich, because I had ignorance, and I had American Way, and I thought he was just the bee's knees, you know, because he sang and played together. Our singer quit showing up, so I had to start singing. So here, only 6 months in to learn how to play the cardboard bass, I was singing and playing, and Phil Rhyme was the guy I was looking at. The other guy was Brad Divins from Wrathchild America. So that was 23 years ago, and now here I am sitting in Hollywood talking to my buddy Doc, opening up for Sacred Reich. So don't give up, kids. Don't ever give up, even if you have to play a cardboard bass.
That's a great story.
Thank you for letting me share that.
Hell yeah. Thanks for coming on the show, brother.
No problem.
And thank you guys for listening. This has been the X-Man, Doc Coyle, with my man OJ. Kicking it. So that was the song Trap Jaw from the latest Byzantine album, The Cicada Tree, available on Metal Blade Records. I hope you guys liked that song. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I thought that was really awesome. I'm telling you, he does have just that sweet southern voice, man. Boy, I wish I had that, you know. Either that or I could speak like Keith David. You guys know who that is. He was in The Thing and, what was that? Something About Mary, you know. Yes, her boyfriend, Woogie. Had to get the beans above the Franks. And he was also in a movie, Requiem for a Dream. You know, Maid Marian. Yes. Ass to ass. I know it's pretty, but I didn't put it out for air. Anyway, I think I just did a really, really bad Keith David impression, so I'm going to stop doing that. Anyway, that was a lot of fun. I might put out another show this week. I don't know. We'll see how I feel, because I feel bad about going a couple weeks between programs here. But I've got some great episodes coming up. I love you guys. This is good stuff. You guys have a great week. Mamba out.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.